You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is part two of my interview with Howard Rice and David Nichols about Howard's planned voyage through Tierra del Fuego and David's film Below 40 South, which will document the journey. Howard, how were you chosen to put the newly developed Scamp through its paces?
I was, as I mentioned earlier, one of the few folks who was sent the initial design sheets on the boat to give input, which I did. And then when the design, I think it was, the change was underway to add a foot to the length. It was just simply too small at 10 feet, 10 inches, I think is what it was. So it was stretched out to a lengthy 11 feet, 11 inches. And it made sense to me. And at that time, Scamp number one, the prototype, had not yet been produced. The design had just been finalized, and the first boat was being built. I immediately got on the phone. I was in Micronesia at the time and contacted Josh Colvin, who was the person producing the Scamp project, and I purchased two kits, sight unseen. I knew the boat was going to work for my purposes, and my plan was to build one stock, sail it, understand it, and then modify it. And as it turns out, I've modified it quite extensively. So I own Scamp hull number 2 and number 3, and I think they're up in the 450 number sail number about now. That was in September of 2010 or 11, I think 2011, I happened to be flying into the States for the holidays in December. And so I flew in and stopped in Seattle and came to Port Townsend, Washington, because the first Scamp number one, the prototype, had been completed in November, launched on November 11th, and sailed, I think, for about an hour, and then put away for the winter. Well, I came in town, and I asked Josh if I could take it out for a winter sail. And so a number of folks showed up at the shop there, and many friends of his and mine helped me with sleeping bag and a poly tarp for camping. And so I actually took the boat out and did the first overnight on it across a little body of water in Port Townsend, Puget Sound. And that night, it started to blow and snow, and the temperature, I believe, it dropped to 18 degrees Fahrenheit with a 10-degree wind chill factor, and I had a great time. I roasted coffee on board, had quite an adventurous night, but it was quite warm because of the gear. After that very spirited sail the next day, it was a romp of a windy, sunny day, winter day. Josh and I talked. And I happened to have been traveling back to the States in March, and it got around to capsize testing, and so I penned the protocol for the capsize testing. I had 14 different capsizes or scenarios, from pitch poling, you know, capsize to starboard to port, full turtle, etc., that we had decided to test. So I came back on March 11th and conducted static calm water in the slip testing, just to see for the first time what a Scamp would do.
David, have you adapted the recording equipment in any way? I mean, I guess you're going to be shooting 4K video, so the cameras will record around 3 hours of footage before Howard has to swap out the SD card. I mean, is that about right? Presumably you've discussed some sort of routine designed to ensure that there's always at least one camera rolling.
Well, those are really good questions. And let me start by saying that initially we had planned to shoot in 4K, and then I began to look at the storage that was involved in 4K, and that was then quickly reduced to 2.5K, and then that was quickly reduced down to 1080p, and this was all dictated by storage. If Howard had been in a 30-foot boat, that wouldn't have been such an issue, but Southern Cross is 11 feet 11 inches long, and so every square inch of volume has to be justified, and every ounce of weight has to be justified. So the logistics of all of this really got to be very interesting, and without getting real geeky about this, it turns out that I would need about 8 terabytes of storage for about 70 hours of video, and then I had to have 8 terabytes of storage for backup. So then all of that then had to be, a system had to be devised to be able to transfer from the cameras to the external hard drives. And Howard has a dedicated laptop that he's going to use to make those transfers. And then the other part of that question, the GoPros can be set to run in a loop. And so part of the sea trial system is developing all of this, and they can be set to run in a loop. And then when something happens that you want to film, you can hit a button and the camera actually starts to roll. So it's always recording in the loop, and then you can hit it and it goes. But the problem with that was that it ate up the little batteries of the GoPro very quickly. And so what we had to come up with was we had to come up with a system that wired the GoPros into a battery bank that allowed them to run on that loop, to be able to be ready to roll at any given moment. And, all of that, really, we kind of have to sit down and work through during the sea trials situations.
How will you then get hold of the recorded material? Is it all got to be stored on those hard drives? I mean, there's no Iridium Go, no data transfer every month. You've got to wait until the end of the voyage.
That's exactly right. When Howard lands, I will be there. My crew and I, or my film crew and I, will be there filming his arrival, and we'll, film interviews and everything. But at that moment, when he steps offshore, that's when I physically will be handed the hard drives and the footage. Now, there may be another opportunity or so to do that, but that's completely up in the air. I mean, this is a very, very organic voyage with no real set path or route per se. It's an ongoing voyage that will take a direction as Howard sees fit. So, but really, what I really have to count on is I have to count on, at the end of the voyage, being handed all of those external hard drives.
If I may, Mike, if I may interject here, I've had now 5 meetings in Chile with the Armada de Chile, the Chilean Navy, and they don't just allow anyone to show up in their waters and sail. It's way too dangerous, and there are a number of requirements that they make of any yacht, and I am sailing a small yacht, to transit their waters. And one of the parameters that they lay out is that you have to sail a particular course. And I've always had a course in mind. David mentioned it's very organic. It can be this or that. That's partially correct. But I know exactly where I'm going. I'm going to be sailing here and then there, and I'm going to turn here, and then we'll see what happens after that. I mean, there will be variances given the moment. There is the opportunity, and this is in the works, back to the question you had asked Dave and his answer, that the Armada does have patrol boats that patrol parts of the region I'm going to be in. They rarely go to the Southwest Islands because it's too dangerous. But if I can hand off, if it can work out, and I can hand off a Pelican box full of filmed material, that might happen if I run into a patrol boat. Those elements are under discussion.
And what about the audio, a subject closer to my heart? Will you rely on the sound from the GoPro cameras, or are you recording it separately?
No, I actually will really rely on the wild sound from the GoPro themselves. We have done some tests, and the audio is really actually surprisingly good. Howard has a dedicated GoPro that is a video diary that he is and will keep on the daily on the voyage, and he's doing that now. And we've done a series of tests. We've listened to the audio for that particular use, and we were satisfied with it.
David, we should mention that your film is being crowdfunded, that listeners can contribute financially to the cost of making this documentary. How much money do you still need to raise? As I recall, it's a relatively small amount of money.
Well, it's about $7,000. Early on, we decided to sort of break the funding down into two parts, the production part, and then fund the post-production part of the film separately. So the production cost, it's camera equipment, and then also the travel to get myself and a film crew to Chile and to cover our costs while we're there. I'd like to say I'm not taking a salary. I'm not paying myself from the budget of this film. And I'm doing everything I can to try and cut costs and stretch the dollars. That $7,000, by the way, is sort of the minimum amount. And there are a lot of individuals who have gotten us to the point where we are at this point, which is about 50%. And they're very much part of the film. But the film also needs like major sponsors and individuals and corporations to step forward at the $1,000 or the $5,000 or the $10,000 level. And like I mentioned a moment ago, the budget that we've posted on the website is just the minimum of what we really need to do the film and to do this film justice.
If I may interject, Mike, Dave Nichols and John Welsford actually are, John is part of the film effort and the crew. I'm not related to the film. The film is an independent project. I'm simply sailing a 12-foot boat through Tierra del Fuego, and any funding that goes toward, I think the budget is something like $13,000 or $14,000, of which Dave is about halfway there and needs another $7,000. None of that comes my way. I'm just by my nature, I just want simplicity, and I'm just going sailing. So everything that I'm doing, the building of my boat, the rigging it, the food, the gear, the clothing, the travel, the ship, everything is out of my own dwindling nest egg. And that's the way I want it. So,
Howard, speaking of a dwindling nest egg, I want to ask you about your wife, Keiko. She is a linguist by profession, a chef by passion, and a food blogger of some renown. How did you sell such a dangerous trip to your wife, a trip during which you will be incommunicado for a considerable length of time?
Well, thank you. Keiko was all those things. I didn't have to sell it to her at all. She knows this is what I aspire to outside of my working life, and it's who I am and what I like to do. So there was no selling. She's always been in support. She trusts me and has been very, very happy to see that I'm happy.
Let me rattle off a few quick-fire questions. If you'll indulge me, these require fairly brief answers. I want to give people a better picture of your life during this trip. So firstly, how will you sleep?
Two different ways. Actually, three. The first way I'll sleep is the practiced cat nap. The nature of the strategy I'm using for sailing down there is that I'm going to be land-bound, tied off or anchored for some days at a time. The last time I was in Tierra del Fuego in my sailing canoe, in the first 21 days I was sailing, I was actually bivouacked in extreme conditions for 20 of those 21 days. When the wind or the weather and the wind is usable, meaning anything up to 30 or so knots, I'll be sailing as fast as I can, as long as I can, and practicing the art of the catnap, which is actually something that must be practiced, and I've mastered that. The second way is I have a tent when I'm at anchor that I can set up that offers significant space in the cockpit. I have a second tent that is a survival tent. It's a one-bow, very low tent from the cuddy top to the back of the boat. And then I have a very small mountaineering tent. When the boat is on land, I can strike that on land and sleep.
How will you keep warm, and how will you heat water?
I'll keep warm by how I dress. Most of the time I'll be in a dry suit with a fleece liner. My boat is equipped with a small wood stove, and that wood stove is, of course, demountable. It's stored below. It's about the size of a shoebox, and it has an integral water jacket on the side of it, and I can heat up about a quart of water. That isn't my primary source for heating up water. I do have a collapsible galley that I've built with two small camping stoves that lock into it.
Where will you find fuel for your fire for a wood-burning stove?
I'm carrying some wood with me when I depart Punta Arenas. There is not actually much wood available. There are some small, very hardwood, gnarled trees in Tierra del Fuego, but I'll be carrying some small bundles of hardwood. I won't have that many fires, and I'll forage for wood.
How will you wash or change your clothes?
In the tent or on land is how I'll change my clothes. I'll be carrying very few clothes. I'm actually traveling backpacker light. The way that I'll wash myself is by heating up water either on my stove, cooking stove, or by building a fire in the wood stove and heating up water in the water jacket.
Will you have a satellite phone?
No, I will not. I won't because I can't afford one, number one. You know, this again is a self-funded voyage, and I have to, you know, I'm at the end of purchasing. I am required by the Armada de Chile to carry an HF radio. I am also carrying three VHF radios and an in-reach DeLorme. The HF radio will only be used in a certain circumstance, and the VHF radios actually don't do me any good. Once I'm 5 miles out of Punta Arenas, I won't see another human being for several months.
What will you do if you get into difficulties? What if you capsize and can't right the boat? What if you're thrown around and you hit your head? How will you summon help?
I'm not sure what difficulties mean, that question. Difficulties come in many forms. I'm going to be prepared based on my experience and the few skills I have to sail safely. And I will sail safely in spite of the place I'm going. I have built a boat that's extremely strong and is set up. I will at certain times be wearing a whitewater river helmet, knee pads, which I wear almost all the time in any case. I don't suppose that I'll get beat up too badly. The inside of the boat, the cockpit, the sole, the floor, the seats are all padded. Inside of the cabin is padded a little bit on the top, and that's mainly for flotation, so I won't bang my head as well. As far as not being able to right the boat will right itself. And the way that this will happen, and I've done, I can't tell you how many capsize scenarios I've been through. I teach people how to avoid capsize and how to right their boats and reenter through a number of classes that I've taught. When I did the capsize testing for the Scamp, I did it very selfishly. The folks at Small Craft Advisor were pretty thrilled that I was coming in to add some expertise to that, but I had a secret agenda. My secret agenda was I wanted to see what the boat would do on its side and upside down. And I was very heartened by what I learned. And I've built a system into my boat where the cuddy cabin is inflatable. And John and I have just finished the writing data on the boat. That was a requirement of the Armada de Chile. And it shows that the boat can likely do a 360. Then it'll come back up at least to its side. And I know the method, because I've pioneered the method for getting the boat upright, and I've set the boat up with a new system, which I sort of call the elevator sling. And I can simply, this is permanently rigged on both sides of the boat. I can get in the sling, and by widening my legs, I get elevated up without any upper body strength needed, flop in the cockpit, and off I go. How will I summon help? The HF radio is the requirement that the Armada has made. That's the one requirement that they've made along with inspecting the boat. An HF radio is very problematic. It eats batteries. So should I break my leg, making sure, and if at that point I elect to contact the Armada, the reason the HF radio is a requirement is they want the ability to put a doctor on the radio with me until they can get there. But that said, I'm not the person who's going to put anybody else in jeopardy. That's not the way that I operate. I'm going out willingly on my own. I don't intend to have any communication with the outside world because I don't want people to be worried in case I can't contact them again. So I'm on my own. I'm a do-it-yourself person, and I take responsibility for where I sail and how I do it. But if push comes to shove and I'm really badly injured, I will flick on that HF radio and let the Armada know where I am and hope that they can come to my assistance. But I'm not expecting that to happen.
Okay, two more. Keiko's Vegan Buckwheat Rice Burger is a bestseller in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm guessing you won't be carrying many of those with you. What will you eat?
Actually, I'm eating a vegetable and grain-based diet because it's a typical meal that I eat. I'm largely a vegetarian, have been for my adult life. Ancient grains. My wife is doing some very interesting pioneering work using an ancient Japanese method for cooking, and she and I have been experimenting with many different meals over the last months, and so I'll largely be making grain-based and hard vegetable, root vegetable meals while I'm underway, which makes for very simple fare.
So we've spoken about this before, you and I, so I know that the question most school kids would ask you is, how will you go to the toilet? So, for the junior members of our audience and for David, whose cameras will be rolling, how will you achieve that?
Carefully. Carefully. Well, you know, that's actually that's sort of a funny answer, but in reality, it's a very important answer. I'm guessing that more than one solo sailor has died falling overboard while trying to use the ocean. In the crudest of terms, it's the bucket and chuck it method, which is unfortunate for where I'm going, but that's the way it's going to have to work. And so to answer your fifth grade elementary school question, carefully and using that very simple method.
This is Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guests today are Howard Rice and David Nichols. In just a few weeks, Howard will set out on an epic voyage around Tierra del Fuego, inarguably one of the most inhospitable places on Earth. He will make the journey in a scamp, a tiny sailboat a little under 12 feet long. We'll take a short break now. When we come back, we'll find out how much all of this is costing.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, director of membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea. From boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
long tail catch, you'll find it. Ho, way, ho, why, you must done. She's the lady say of the salty times. Clear away the track and let the bull giant run to me. Hey, rig a jig, she's a jaunting free.
We're living our dream.
We're living simply and sustainably aboard a sailboat travelling the world.
We're visiting remote communities and raising awareness about the health of our oceans.
Patrolling the oceans for microplastic particles.
We're checking on the health of coral reefs and phytoplankton populations.
We're monitoring marine mammals and examining synthetic materials in fish.
We're Bass and Jamie Van Jones.
And we're proof that citizen science can save the world.
Hear all about our amazing adventures in salty times every week here on Boat Radio.
Stay salty.
You.
And the boat of the ladies say, clear away the tack and let the boat giant run.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a ripoff. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. We will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats, and all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to Howard Rice and David Nichols. Howard is planning a voyage through Tierra del Fuego in a sailboat less than 12 feet long. And David is documenting the preparations and the journey for the film Below 40 South. David, how much footage do you anticipate having to sit through during the editing process? And how on earth will you distill 3 months or so of adventure and daring do into one relatively short film?
Well, it's not going to be a very easy task, because I suspect that virtually every minute of film that we get will be interesting and fascinating. And the first part of the question, I think, is I expect to have to look through a minimum of 70 hours of raw footage. And the diary that I spoke of earlier, I think, is going to be the key element in terms of tying things together as a story. That almost will dictate the storyline. It is a linear journey. So what happens as the journey progresses will also, kind of dictate the story and the direction the story takes.
Is the danger to Howard, with whom I presume you are on good terms, something you've wrestled with? I mean, is it fair to say, broadly speaking, that peril ensures exciting footage? So the greater the danger to Howard, the better the final film.
It is something that I've thought about, because the cameras do add an element of risk and complication. I've said to Howard that the cameras and the shot, everything like that's expendable, and nothing is worth taking a risk for. And even if, I mean, Howard is actually a good friend. We've become very close friends over the course of making this film. But even if Howard weren't a good friend, I couldn't even ask a stranger to take a risk for making a film. For a couple of reasons. Number one, it's just not like me to do that. But, you know, taking risks for a film sort of smacks of reality TV. And I don't want this film to be anything like reality TV. Reality TV is certainly a legitimate form of entertainment, but it's just not what I want this film to be. And I think that if Howard thought that it was going to be anything like that, then he wouldn't want any part of it either. In terms of, you know, the risks and everything, we've worked really hard. I've worked very hard to try and make these cameras and the making of the film to not be a distraction and to not create extra risk. There's enough risk involved in just the journey itself.
Mike, if I may interject a comment here, I have probably been the worst subject for a documentary that Dave has ever come up against. we chuckle. I've really felt on the horns of a dilemma with the idea of doing a documentary, and there has to be a good reason why I'm doing it, because I happen to think that filming while sailing a small boat is inherently dangerous. There's equipment, there is the process of taking an SD card out of a camera and, you know, putting it in a dry container and doing this and that, when I have enough to do as it is. So I'm motivated to do this almost at times reluctantly, because I think where I'm going is one of those places left on Earth where very few people have been or have seen images of. And I'm going to be sailing in the footprint of the Yaghan, the footprint and the wakes of the Yaghan, an ancient culture, one of the most interesting cultures on Earth that is essentially extinct now, that traveled throughout the Southwest Islands in open boats. Darwin, aboard the HMS Beagle, looked at them and found them to be remarkable in their open boats with fires. And there's a parallel with my boat, a 12-foot boat with a wood stove. They basically traveled essentially without clothing, and within a couple of generations after contact with Westerners, they were on their way to extinction. They essentially died of the common cold. When I was on my last trip there, I was where I would find sanctuary, that place up ahead where I could see a crack in the cliffs and I would be able to pull in and stop there. I almost every time would find some remnants of the Yaghan. And so I'm willing to do this film, to work with Dave for his film. It's not my film, for his film, to record some of these campsites and some of this for the public record, and as an inspiration for other people. So I'm willing to go through the extra element and the trouble of setting up the boat and the danger of operating the cameras, because it is genuine.
David, if I can come back to you, Timothy Treadwell, do you remember him?
Yes.
The Grizzly Man. When I spoke to Howard about this interview a few weeks ago, he mentioned Timothy Treadwell. To those listening who don't know of Treadwell, he lived with grizzly bears, and he was the subject of a documentary film made by Werner Herzog. During the making of this documentary film, he and his girlfriend were killed and eaten by the grizzly bears. And the film became a huge hit, actually, I think, largely because of Treadwell's demise. I mean, I've never sat through the whole film. I'm sure it was a beautifully made documentary, but its success largely stemmed from the publicity surrounding its subject's death. David, will you go ahead and make the film if Howard dies?
That's a very good question, and I thought long and hard about it, and I talked to Howard about it. And I asked Howard early on if he would want me to finish the film, and his answer was yes. And I think that Howard trusts me to do justice to the film and to honor his memory and our friendship. But it was a brief conversation. It's not something I dwell on a lot. Howard is a survivor. And not something, because Howard is such a survivor, it's not something that I spend a lot of time dwelling on. We had a brief conversation about it, but it was a brief conversation.
The film is called Below 40 South. Do you anticipate it being shown on Netflix or on the National Geographic Channel?
Those are both options. And also theatrical release is certainly an option. And it's something that has been, I think we'll have to make those decisions when we sit down and look at the raw footage and see what we actually have. And then we can make those decisions. But all three of those are definitely on the table.
Howard, the cost of the film doesn't cover the cost of the expedition. How much has it set you back so far, personally?
To put a price tag on it, I haven't kept a completely detailed listing of costs, but it's well in excess of $30,000, probably pushing. I'll do a tally soon. It's a scary number. It's about $30,000 to $35,000, spread over a number of years. I haven't spared any expense in, building the boat, fitting it out with the best bronze hardware. I've made a number of custom things. You know, I purchased a stove and customized the wood stove, customized it. The shipping crate was quite an expensive item. The dollar amount I've given you also reflects the cost of shipping 700-pound, fully loaded, ready-to-go boat and a 16-foot by 5-foot by 5-foot wood shipping crate from the United States to one of the most remote places on Earth and back. So it's been expensive and gladly spent.
And still, your wife did not object.
No. We, my wife is a wonderful human being and a very, we live a very close but autonomous life. You know, she pursues her passions and I pursue mine, and we support each other because we're both passionate people.
You have lived for most of the past two decades in Micronesia, where you have been closely involved in proposals for the creation of the world's largest marine park. How long have you been passionate about ocean conservation, and will there be an ecological element, if that's the right term, to this latest trip? Will you collect data or document natural phenomena?
Well, I have been involved in, I created the concept of the World Park, which would have, which if it is successful, will create the world's largest marine park, a living park, a park where people go about their lives, and yet they have a plan for how they will develop their 1.3 million square miles of the Western Pacific in a sustainable manner. So on this particular voyage, it was interesting that in the most important meeting that I engaged in with the Armada de Chile, they had the Armada head of international security and the head of the environmental section there. Much of the area where I will be sailing is the same. It's unchanged over thousands of years or hundreds of years, but there has been a dramatic change since the last time I was there. And now there is a preserve, the Cape Horn Preserve and Park covers most of the area that I'll be sailing in. So it was to my advantage that I didn't have an engine. I was sailing engineless. The Armada is very remiss to let any yacht come in that's not fully inspected, because they end up with wrecks and fuel spills. As to your question, will I be recording data and that kind of thing? I don't have any plan to do that. I know that many folks do that sort of thing. But I'll be observing. I'll be very interested to see what has changed since I was last there. The last time I was there, I didn't see any trash. on the beaches, which is quite common. The waters seem pristine and pure, and my hope is it will be the same.
We should make it clear that this voyage is not being undertaken lightly. You have many years of experience conducting open ocean expeditions in small boats. Tell us, if you can, about your work with the U.S. Department of Defense. You've trained U.S. Special Forces and Navy SEALs, I understand.
That's correct. I've actually only worked with one Navy SEAL, but I have worked with U.S. Special Forces combat swimmers, both the 10th Mountain Division and the Combat Swimmer Group out of the U.S. Army Combat Swimmer Group out of Key West, Florida. In the day, I was involved with Klepper folding boats, and we meaning my partner Eric Stiller and I, did a number of trainings with U.S. Special Forces combat swimmers in Klepper black blacks, they're called, or green black military boats. Kleppers are used by NATO Special Forces. I've worked with a number of NATO groups for infiltration, exfiltration, and I was privileged to be one of the authors of the folding boat section of the MAROPS manual, Marine Operations Manual, and develop sailing rigs for their boats. One of the issues they have is infiltrating to do hostage rescue, for example. And by the way, the way that I'm not of the military bent, but the way that I justified my being involved with the military is that they do utilize the boats for such activities as hostage rescue. They're not only used for reconnaissance and combat, but they're used for that purpose. So I can't say much more than that. Not that there's anything special that I have in my mind, or not that I'm under any orders not to say anything. It was a very interesting part of my life. I think I learned more than I imparted. It was a long and great chapter in my experiences.
David, when you first saw the plans for the Scamp, this little boat that's going to take Howard through some of the most forbidding waters on Earth, were you surprised at how old-fashioned it looked? I mean, when you compare it to the modern enclosed rowing and pedal-powered vessels with the solar panels on top that take people across the Atlantic, do you not think that Southern Cross, with its little round portholes and its chimney and its bronze Merriman winch, looks like something from a bygone age?
Well, yes, it does look traditional, and it does look like something maybe from a bygone era. But I think that's a good thing. I think what that means to my mind is that the sails and all of the systems are really time-tested. The sails, for example, are a mix of the traditional, which, you know, I've always said that there's a level of Marine Darwinianism involved with the traditional working boat sails and the high tech, you know, and with Southern Cross, you get the best of both worlds. You get, you know, the traditional, and then you get the high tech. You know, if I were going to pick a boat to do what Howard is doing, I think this boat or a boat very much like it would have been my choice. And I think I would have been surprised if the choice had been otherwise with Howard.
Howard, you're transporting the Scamp to your departure point in a shipping crate, but, and forgive me if this is a silly question, have you even found, you know, a suitable spot from which to launch Southern Cross?
Yes. I actually, Mike, had been hard at the task of getting my boat completed and shipped on December 28th of 2015. That was my target date, and ran into a few issues. I had questions I couldn't answer with Chilean customs and a few other things. So this is my trip. It's my voyage. I'm not marching to anyone else's drummer. I don't have sponsors, so I'm not beholden to them. So I just decided to go to Chile without the boat and spend the month of February answering questions. And one of the questions amongst many that I answered was, where will I stage the boat and do some sailing on the Strait of Magellan? Where will I provision? Where will I get my food, etc.? So in February, my dear friend of 30-some years, John Welsford, asked to come along, and he and I traveled to Chile. He was invaluable in the meetings with the Navy, and we spent a couple of days on foot in Punta Arenas, which is where the boat will be shipped to, walking the beach and filming and taking photographs. And I found one excellent place and a couple of pretty good places to stage the boat. The boat has to come out of the crate and very quickly be moved off of the customs dock because they charge by the day. And so I'm in the crate. I'm carrying a collapsible small trailer, which I will assemble when the boat crate is open. The boat comes out on the trailer. And one of the other questions I answered is, where am I going to keep this crate, this 16-foot by 5-foot by 6-foot, I think it is, large wooden crate, because I'll need it when I'm done. And so I made some great friends in Chile. You know, Mike, it's interesting. One of the aspects of sailing small boats that I've discovered in my life that is so endearing to me and fun is when I pull into an anchorage and rattle out, you know, a few feet of little tiny chain and an anchor in amidst a fleet of big yachts, people tend to smile and think it's just the most novel, fun thing they've ever seen. And so that's happening in Chile. There are folks, Chileans, who I've become friends with, and one of them is going to store the crate for me. They just think it's a wonderful little voyage I'm going on.
So you're bringing her back?
I hope so. I don't know for sure. I cannot say for sure. The boat is expendable, and I hope to bring her back, but if the bank account is broken, I'll just sell the boat in Chile and come back without it.
And you're due to set off when exactly?
I'm planning to ship the boat at this point because, again, it's my time schedule, and the sailing there is dictated by the seasons. You can either sail in the dead of winter, which is in some ways advantageous, and I could do that, which is we're coming up on the southern winter right now. It started. I plan to ship the boat about the last week of September of this year. It will take approximately 6 weeks to arrive in Punta Arenas. I will travel to Chile sometime either in the second, right after I ship the boat, during the end of September or early October, and will likely set off. My plan is to set off in November and take the time that I need to explore the southern Strait of Magellan, west out through Peninsula Brecknock and south through the truly unknown, and I hate to sound dramatic like that, but it's true, the lee shore islands, the southwest islands, and they're a lee shore, they're pounded by the roaring 40s, and I've got the right boat to get in there and take a look and see what I see. And then from there, I'll sail back up into the Beagle Channel and put the boat back in the box if I can afford it and ship it home.
And how long will you be at sea, and will there be any way for us to follow your progress?
I don't know how long I'll be at sea. The voyage is rather difficult to plan. I have a route that I'm planning, and there are optional routes that I can take to get out to the Southern Ocean. So I could be underway for anywhere from 6 weeks to 3 months. That part is very difficult to predict. As I mentioned on my previous voyage, in the first 21 days from the point that I set out, I was only underway for 1 day. It was impossible for 10 days the first time, that first session. I was landbound in 70 knot winds and snow for 10 days. And I had one bright sunny day with very usable about 20 knots of wind, and then slam, 10 days again, where I was fully exposed in the open right on the Southern Ocean with a lot of wind. So it's hard to know. I'm going to be sailing safely. I sail very conservatively. I hope I'm not landbound, but I'm sure I will be for long periods of time. As far as being able to communicate, I will have an in-reach DeLorme device, which is about the size of small GPS, which will allow me to push the button and alert a short list of people back in the civilized world with my latitude and longitude. And should I decide to do that, I can also send and receive text messages. The HF radio will only be used as a last-ditch necessity. Again, I'm not going to put anybody else in jeopardy or danger. I don't intend to rely on the Chilean Navy. I know what it means. When they go out, they're really in peril. So the HF radio will probably not be used.
David, where, and by where I mean where online, can people find out more about your wonderful documentary?
The film has a website, and the website is www.below40south.com, and that's the number 40, below40south.com. And there are lots of interesting videos about a lot of the things that Howard has talked about, the tent and the stove and the systems that he's using in the boat. And then, of course, as well as ways to get caps and T-shirts and posters as well.
And Howard, you've created a blog in support of David's work to document your voyage. Where can people find that?
You can just go online and type in The Voyage of Southern Cross. I put that blog up right after returning from Chile. I think it was on March 3rd or thereabouts, and it's been amazing. It's had, now it's pushing 28,000 reads since that time. And the reason I have it is I'm also a donor to the film. I'm not financially involved in the film anyway. The film really is about a small boat. I happen to be the guy in the boat, but it's really about the pluck of a small boat. And so I support what Dave is doing. I hope that my experience might inspire some people. I've been working with some elementary school groups, kids, taking photographs and helping them expand their world. Because back in the day when I was a little boy, Robert Manry inspired me. And that changed the course of my life. So the Below 40South.com website is the place to go to support the film. And if you want to read more about the systems of my boat, about the Yaak Hunt people, about what I'm going through to put all this together, then that would be the blog, The Voyage of Southern Cross.
Howard Rice, currently in Michigan, I wish you the very best of luck, and I'm certain you are going to inspire an entire generation of school kids, girls and boys, to step outside of what is considered normal and to live courageously, which is so important. And David Nichols in Texas, I look forward very much to watching Below 40 South, hopefully at my local cinema. Thank you both very much for speaking to Boat Radio.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you. It was a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciated the time, and it was great to meet you on the radio.
In the wheelhouse tomorrow, Emily Svensson leads her round-the-world sailor father on a quest to find his long-lost boat, and she documents their journey on film. It is a fascinating tale that is not to be missed, and you will find a teaser trailer for the movie Sailing on a Shoestring on the Boat Radio website at boatradio.net.